This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. Let's be clear, we're a business show, but unlike others, we're not here to talk about business tactics. We're not even really here to talk about economic value of business. We're here to talk about profit, but profit in a wholly different way. Each week in this podcast, I'll talk to some of the leading thinkers and researchers, entrepreneurs and executives about value, the social and moral value of business. As these ideas feel all the more urgent as we as a planet face enormous challenges, climate change, pandemics, and demands for social reform. Many of these challenges brought about, some would argue, by capitalism. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. Nobel Peace Laureate Jody Williams sent a powerful message last year to Chevron. Pay the $9.5 billion you owe in liability for polluting the Ecuadorian Amazon.
I honestly believe in the greater good. I believe that what we should do is take actions that make the world better for everyone.
Jody was one of 29 other Nobel laureates who signed an open letter in support of thousands of victims of Chevron's toxic dumping. They also called on Chevron to stop persecuting U.S. environmental and human rights lawyer Stephen Donziger, who pursued oil spill compensation claims on behalf of the indigenous people of Ecuador. Stephen took on the case and won the largest court judgment in history for human rights and environmental violations. And then he was put under house arrest, where he's been for the past year and is still today. But that may change pending Stephen's contempt hearing next week for refusing to turn over to Chevron privileged attorney-client information. In this bonus episode of What Does It Profit?, I want to revisit and expand on the conversation that we had in our very first episode about this mother of all environmental disasters and courtroom dramas. The timing of this episode seems particularly right, given that we are a week before the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden, whose administration promises an amped-up focus on the seriousness of global environmental crisis. So serious are they that they've already tapped my neighbor, former Secretary of State John Kerry, to serve as a special envoy on climate to the National Security Council. For our part at What Does It Profit?, we'd like to think of this bonus episode as an homage to the importance of taking seriously the impact of what we do for the common good. And who better to share her insights than a Nobel Peace Laureate, who we met in conjunction with her advocacy efforts at the 2020 Chevron shareholder meeting. Let's talk with Jody Williams in this bonus episode of What Does It Profit? And now let's welcome to What Does It Profit? Jody Williams. Jody is a 1997 Nobel Peace Laureate and a new shareholder activist. Welcome to What Does It Profit?
Thank you for inviting me. I'm really pleased. I like what you do. Informing
me. I like what you do. So let's move on with this mutual admiration society and talk some business.
Excellent.
Tell us a little bit more about what's happening in Ecuador with Chevron.
Sure. It's a long story in terms of time in between Texaco and Chevron's pollution of Ecuador, but the facts are very straightforward. Texaco started polluting the Ecuadorian Amazon in 1964 and continued for decades, dumping billions of gallons of oil into the jungle, destroying the environment for the tribes and poor people living there trying to get by. When Chevron purchased Texaco, it purchased also the liability of having polluted the jungle. The area there is known as the Ecuadorian Chernobyl. Suit has been brought against Chevron. The company fought for quite a while to have the case heard in Ecuador. My personal feeling and some things that have been said over time is that they thought they could control the judicial system in Ecuador. That has not turned out to be true. The place where they have been able to control the judicial system is in the United States of America.
Well, tell us about that story. You would think, just as you say, it would be the other way around. So how does that happen in, you know, the land of democracy and law and order and rule of law?
When it comes to big corporations, they pretty much get away with doing whatever they want. As we know, it takes a lot of work and a long time to fight them in order to find justice. There have been many cases in the U.S. where lawyers have fought for the rights of people who have been sickened by the use of pesticides or by oil left in their land, et cetera, et cetera. It's never easy. In the case of Chevron, though, it's been particularly brutal, to be quite frank.
Why so bad?
Chevron has wanted to demonstrate not only are the little brown people they don't care about in Ecuador unable to see justice done, but that they are willing to attack brutally the American lawyer, Stephen Donziger, who has been the lead lawyer in their case for 2 decades. They have manipulated the judicial system in such a way that Donziger is under house arrest before he has even had his trial for contempt of court for refusing to give up his records of privileged conversations with his clients to Chevron, as has been ordered by the, in my view, corrupt judge that they worked with.
Well, you know, that sounds like there are layers and layers of drama and abuse and recklessness that have happened. As you know, I can imagine this. These are the kinds of things that get Nobel laureates engaged in this kind of activism. How did you, as a renowned peace activist in the landmine area, get engaged with this kind of environmental disaster?
Mm-hmm. My interests are beyond landmines. I haven't actually worked on that issue for quite a while. Since 2006, I've been the chairwoman of the Nobel Women's Initiative, which brings together 5 Nobel Peace laureates who are women. And we use our influence and access, you know, to influence issues in the world that are of concern to us, to women, particularly in conflict zones who are struggling to sustain some sense of peace during war. I'm very involved and interested in the environment, as anyone who looks at the world should be. I actually happened to have met Stephen Donziger decades ago. I didn't even remember.
This is Stephen, the human rights lawyer who's been working with the plaintiffs in Ecuador.
Yes, a very close friend of mine has been and her husband have been supporting him. She called and asked if I would meet with them virtually, of course, because we're all housebound because of COVID. And she reminded me that I had met him. I was working in Central America. He was at that point a journalist on the wars in Central America. We met briefly. But when she reminded me of that, I wanted to hear him tell me his story and the story of Ecuador. And I immediately became consumed with the case, so to speak. I was really angry, especially and shocked, as you seem to sound when you asked about Chevron and the judicial system. I was totally stunned that Chevron has been able to manipulate the judicial system to have Donziger under house arrest when the actual charge of contempt of court only carries a 6-month penalty. If you're convicted, the poor man has been in his house with an ankle bracelet on for 11 months.
I don't know how that happens. And it certainly doesn't sound like the Chevron way. I was enthralled by your testimony at the recent shareholders meeting at Chevron, where you brought it right back to the company, referencing the Chevron way. What is that way?
Well, they say that their way is, you know, all of their work is done to the benefit of the communities in which they work, that they strive to protect human rights and the interest of the communities where they pollute. They don't say that part, but they strive to protect the communities and give them benefits, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at the Chernobyl that they have helped create, it is a complete lie. But the story is not getting out there. They have also put pressure on journalists, on very famous newspapers, to not tell the story, other than the perspective of Chevron. So it's not just the judicial system, it's freedom of speech, freedom of press.
Well, for our avid listeners out there who want to know more about this story, there's actually a very good documentary called Crude available for free download on YouTube if you're interested in a more in-depth look at the story and some of the firsthand person accounts of those who are affected by this horrific pollution. And all of the damage that comes after that.
I honestly did not believe that in this country that kind of thing could happen. Chevron was charged with paying $9.5 billion to clean up its mess. It has already spent approaching $3 billion in lawyers, in PR firms, in God knows what else. Demonize Stephen Donziger, and to make the people in Ecuador, the 30,000 plaintiffs, pay for seeking environmental justice. They've spent $3 billion. Why not just pay and get it done with, like Bayer apparently is doing when it bought Roundup, and with that bought the liabilities that came with Roundup?
Well, you would think that their shareholders would just be up in arms with this because this affects not only the reputation of the company, which oil companies' reputations are challenged in this new world that we live in, but, you know, it's a real business issue. So here you've got a voice at the stakeholder meeting. How did this group come together? Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Amazon Watch and with Newground Social Investment.
Sure. Amazon Watch has been involved in the Chevron case, supporting the people of the Amazon in their quest for justice. Okay. They, of course, know Donziger, and we have been involved in conversations about this. They're educating me about the whole trajectory of Texaco, then Chevron, then the judgment against Chevron, then Chevron selling out and fleeing Ecuador in order to avoid cleaning up its mess. And then all of the things that they have been doing against Donziger and anybody who tries to raise their voice. My association with Newground Social Investments came when they asked if I would be interested in speaking on their behalf at the virtual shareholders meeting. I was, of course, after all my involvement now, very interested in having that opportunity. I would have preferred to be able to go there in person, but given COVID, that's not where we're at these days. But being able to speak virtually, and they listened, made me feel very, very good.
Now, Jody, tell us a little bit more about Amazon Watch. Who is this organization and what is it that they do?
Amazon Watch does not look at Amazon, the corporation, although one might assume so. Amazon Watch looks at environmental pollution in the Amazon, which is often called the lungs of the world. It's an NGO, non-governmental organization, working to try to help us all live in a better world. It's not the only one that works on this, but it's the one that I know better than the others at this point in time.
Talk about that resolution. It's the special meetings resolution. What is that all about?
Well, the resolution asks the directors for the ability to be able to call special meetings with a lower percentage of the shareholders agreeing. And my argument to them, apart from their way, the Chevron way, was that they were doing harm to the shareholders who have not had the opportunity to call special meetings to talk about the impact on Chevron, on shares, of what they have been doing in the Amazon and not doing in the Amazon and what they've been doing against Stephen Donziger. Apparently, the vote was much higher after my ability to speak on behalf of the shareholders. I think generally it was around 17%, perhaps, in support of that resolution. This time it was 34%, which means that we are finally making ingrounds in helping people look beyond the Chevron way to the Chevron reality.
Now, Jody, tell us a little bit more about this tool that we're calling shareholder activism. How does it function? What does it enable to have happen during the shareholder process, the shareholder annual meeting process, where shareholders get together and help give direction to corporations?
I became aware of shareholder activism decades ago, honestly, when I was working on issues related to the wars in Central America, particularly El Salvador and Nicaragua. There was and still is an organization of nuns, the name of which always, of course, escapes me, especially because it was decades ago, that bought shares so that they could go to meetings and bring up issues related to the particular company and how it was involved in war. I thought it was just amazing and outstanding that these religious women would get involved that way and raise their voices in places where they could really influence the thinking of people who owned that corporation. So when I was invited to consider speaking at the Chevron meeting, I was very aware in the past of this kind of activism and have a lot of respect for it. So I was pleased that I was invited to participate.
Tell us some more about the gravitas that comes with your 28 other Nobel colleagues behind you and how that coalition came together, because yours was the vocal voice, but there was a lot of solidarity behind you.
In general, I have worked with the Peace Laureates because I know the majority of them, right? And especially the Nobel Women's Initiative, since we are five Nobel Women Laureates, we often produce statements on issues of concern to us and the women's organizations and conflict zones with which we work. Another Nobel from, I think he's chemistry or medicine, got in touch with me once and wanted to be involved in getting other laureates from other Nobel disciplines involved. So when I was talking with Donziger and Amazon Watch and my friends who got me involved in this particular case, the idea came up to write an open statement, and I would reach out to all disciplines of laureates. And we have representatives from each discipline, from literature, from chemistry, from physics, from economics, etc., who have signed the statement calling for justice, both for the people of Ecuador and for Stephen Donziger.
Well, we'll make sure that our listeners have access to that statement. We'll put a link to it in our show notes. I think it's a important statement on the moral capacity to bear witness to those who are really marginalized. Now, you know, talking about sticking up for the little guy, where does that come from in you? Do you have any place in your background that kind of was the seed that was planted somewhere in your world that got you motivated to have this kind of activist worldview?
In thinking about it, you know, once I got the Nobel Prize, shockingly, although it made both of my parents extremely happy because neither finished high school, people always say, how did you get to be the way you are? But over the years, I have come to realize that it's my father. Dad died almost 20 years ago of lung cancer. But my dad was a child of the Depression, as was my mother. He was on the welfare system of the time. He had to go to the general store in his teeny town. I don't even know what the population might have been. Maybe 100 families, maybe 200. And get the welfare check, whatever it was called during the Great Depression. And his family was always I don't know how to say this other than ripped off by the people controlling that money. They would always take a percentage of the money that was for my father's family. He was one of six children. He was the oldest. And so not only did they have nothing to live on, they had to live on less than nothing because part of the resources were being stolen from each family. It wasn't just to my father's family. So my father had a very strong resentment to people in power who would take advantage of, oppress, etc., what he called the little guy. You know, he was always on the side of the little guy. And over the years, I have come to realize that that sunk in deeper as one of the elements of why I became an activist than I had been aware of when I was younger. So thanks, Dad.
Absolutely. We could all say that in some form or fashion. And that's kind of the spirit of what we talk about here on What Does It Profit? You know, what is the legacy that we leave? How does your work benefit others? So I guess I'll ask you, Jody. I mean, you've had an extraordinary career and have influenced countless people in the process. What does it profit for you?
I honestly believe in the greater good. I believe that what we should do is take actions that make the world better for everyone, even people we don't know, and even, especially, including people we do not like. And I may have the Nobel Peace Prize, but I am not Mother Teresa. There are many people I do not like. I don't like their behavior. I don't like their attitude. I don't like their sexism, their racism, etc. I still want the world to be better for them too. That to me is the fundamental, should be the fundamental, you know, engine of working for social change, to make the world better for everyone. And I hope in that process, some people come to understand that when the world is better for everybody, we all benefit. We don't benefit from oppressing other people.
And certainly all of that is bad for business. But do you think business can be good? Do you think business can be a force for good?
I think it can be. I think it takes a lot of work. I mean, the bottom line for businesses for decades has been making money and making money for the shareholder. I think back to when I was a child, my father owned a little general store in the town of 1,200 people where I grew up until I was seven. And he helped people. He gave credit when he had nothing himself. You know, he understood his place as running a general store in the teeny community where people were still battered from the Depression. He understood that he had to run that store in a way that benefited others, even if it cost him in a way. Sometimes the credit got, you know, out of control and people didn't pay.
Oh, no, I hear you. My dad owned a bar, and so I think he was the town psychiatrist.
I understand that. Yeah.
And when you sell a draft beer under a dollar, you get a lot of therapy.
My dad had a bar. My father worked several jobs at the same time while I was growing up, and he did have a bar. Finally, my mother said, it's the bar or me, husband.
Jody, we're soul sisters.
Yeah. So,
Jody, this has been a pleasure talking to you. And truly, we thank you for the work that you do. We'll do our best to let our listeners know where to find some of these resources. You've moved the needle a little bit at Chevron. It's working at glacier pace.
Usually does. Thanks for what you do, too. Thanks for bringing information to people who otherwise wouldn't know these things.
Well, then let's get them inspired by your activism to go out and make some change. Jody, thanks for joining us on What Does It Profit?
Thank you, ma'am.
This is What Does It Profit? Thanks to those listeners who followed us on our journey through our first season. We hope you enjoyed the listen. And thanks to all those who've gotten the word out about the show. especially our friends at CastBox and our fellow podcasters with whom I've shared conversation at Democracy Works, Uncertain Things, If I Only Knew, and Fresh Blood. In the next episode, we begin season two with a conversation with George Valdez, the Cuban-American money man behind the most notorious drug operation in U.S. history, and now the subject of a forthcoming series called Cocaine Cowboys, Los Muchachos, coming soon to a streaming service near you.
Why was it so difficult for Pablo Escobar or El Chapo? They had as much money as you did, as many airplanes as you did, as many fake passports as you did. Why wouldn't they go? Well, first of all, why wouldn't they ever get out of the business, number one? And number two, why wouldn't they go to a foreign country where there's no extradition? And yet it was so easy for you to get out. I said it was easy for me because I never saw myself as a drug dealer. My identity was I was a businessman. And because I was a businessman, I had a lot of different businesses.
In the meantime, please rate and review us on wherever you're listening and tell your friends about the show. Let us know what you think about the importance of thinking about the moral and social value of business. Email a brief audio file to our production team at producer@whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com and we will include you in the conversation. And as always, ratings, reviews, and subscriptions on your favorite podcast platform mean so much to us. Follow us on social media to keep up with the show and to help build the What Does It Profit community. We'd love to hear from you. What Does It Profit is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter.
The show is produced by Jordan Gaspour.
Executive producers are Nate Toby, Barbara Landis, and special thanks to our talented interns, Niels and Hannah, and our long and illustrious group of friends and supporters found at our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?